Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hi, this is Mike Wilbur along with Tom Shan. This session of the Apparatus Architects, and today, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very, very special guest. We have Mr. Dick Young. Many of you from years past will remember Dick as really just an innovative apparatus guy who at one time had his own apparatus company, very infamous for the Young Crusader cab, which was a favorite of mine. A local fire department down the street, the Silver Lake Fire Department, had one of those. And talk about driving. Wow, that cab had some of the best sight angles and some of the best drivability that any that were ever made. And since that time, Dick has gone on to found a company by the name of PAC that does a lot of apparatus marketing. Like I just told Brother Tom, I think the world of him. The man was had so much forethought and was just way ahead of his time, very innovative. And I'd like to welcome Mr. Dick Young to the broadcast.
Thank you. I appreciate your invitation. My head just got about three sizes bigger.
Well, this is it's Tom Shane and I, together with Mike, would like to welcome Dick. I have the distinct pleasure of we're recording this in Dick's office here at his company, Performance Advantage Company, here in Lancaster, New York. And while I have known Dick for probably 25 plus 30 years, quick little opening. This takes me back to the year was 1969. I was a senior in high school, had just gotten my license, and occasionally, since we were a one-car family, on evenings, I had learned early on after doing around and doing buffing in my home county of Rockland County, New York, learned what nights the different fire companies had drills, which gave you the best opportunity at least to talk to people since they were all volunteer organizations, and to look at rigs. So on one July night, in 1969, I was lucky to get the Shan family truckster. I'm out driving around with my girlfriend at the time, and we drove past the firehouse in Orangeburg, New York. Oh, wow. And I saw sitting on the ramp for the very first time a Young Crusader, which caused me to tap the brakes, turn on the left turn signal, and pull into the fire station. Well, about an hour and a half later, I went back to rejoin my girlfriend, who obviously dumped me shortly thereafter. But that was my first opportunity to ever see a Young Crusader fire truck. While I was very familiar with the name, and then in later years, the hometown bought a pumper, and it's just been a pleasure for these many years to know Dick, and for each of us in our respective careers at this point. Dick recently just turned the ripe old age of 80 and is still very, very active in the operating of his company, and I would consider to be the premier innovator in fire apparatus, bar none. So for some of our listeners who maybe just started the fire in their fire service career in the last 5 to 10 years, and if you're out in the Midwest or the West Coast, you're maybe not familiar with Young fire equipment, but we'll let Dick start out here by giving a brief little history of how he got in to the fire apparatus industry, starting out based on his family experience. So, Dick, how did things start out for you?
I was really born into the business. My dad was the old Buffalo Fire Appliance Company 2 years before I was born, and he was assistant to the president and very involved in many of the things. And just as you asked me the question, Tom, I remember a discussion that was had one time. Most of the fire pumps were rotary positive displacement pumps. And when the centrifugal pump came along, they said that the rotary pump could push water backwards through the centrifugal pump. And so they had a contest. And of course, if you remember on the positive displacement pumps, you had to be make sure you were in the right gear. But they weren't really built for pressure. But in any event, same engines, but two different pumps, and the centrifugal pump stalled the rotary pump. That was back probably in 1934.
Wow, so if you look at how fire apparatus has evolved, and a number of years ago, together with a good friend, Leo DeLieb and I, we authored a book on chronicling the history of Dick's company in later years that he formed, and we'll let Dick get into that. But Dick, what year did Buffalo Fire Appliance morph or change into the company then that you worked with for many years that had your name in?
Well, when my dad started in with a couple other guys from Buffalo Fire Appliance building smaller trucks. If you remember Buffalo, they had the old custom chassis, big Hercules engines. And it was an expensive truck. So they decided, my dad did, that they could build a less expensive truck on a smaller chassis that would work in most of the volunteer departments. And so they started a little company to make those trucks, and we have one upstairs in the museum that's a real beauty, hand-built beauty. 1935.
Yeah, for those listeners, if you ever find yourself out into the, as a sidebar, out into the western New York area, Dick has just a fabulous museum here chronicling partially the history of the company, but also of the fire service in western New York, and specifically the fire companies that serve, various fire companies that serve the town of Lancaster, New York, and it's located right here in the downtown area of Lancaster. So if you ever find yourself that you're wandering up here for whatever reason or going up to Niagara Falls, it's an excellent stop and something that you want to check out, and it's once again an incredible step back into time to look at what firefighting was like back in those eras. So Dick, it was interesting to me, you mentioned that the Buffalo Fire Appliance, which were maybe almost parallel to what Cadillac vehicles looked like of the day, that very, very large conventional engine ahead, large fenders, and apparently was quite expensive to build, but even back in that era, post-Depression, that people were sensitive to what the cost of fire trucks are. Here we go, fast forward into 2010, and once again, we're kind of reliving those issues. So how did Young start from those somewhat humble times of making these smaller rigs to run from there, say, up until the 1950 era?
Well, Tom, I was a kid and grew up in the shop. As did my brother. But in 1948, I was in the Navy in China and a couple of years there, and then went to college, and then the Korean War started, so I got called back for that. In any event, when I got out of the Navy was about 1951, and my dad wanted me to be in the fire truck business, and I didn't really want to. I loved radio broadcasting, and that's what I wanted to do. But he had a heart attack, and he needed help. So I got in the fire truck business with him, and then shortly thereafter, my brother did too. So now, instead of one family eating off of a company, there was three. So the only way you can do that is you got to get more business. Go out and get more business. So America LaFrance was close by, Ward LaFrance, Sanford, Maxim. They were companies that were really relatively close by, so the only way we could get business was to do something better than they did, or different than they did. So that's where the innovation started. That, unfortunately, has been my middle name.
Well, you know, again, for our listeners, if you think about chronicling going back now in... We're in the decade of the 50s, and we'll bring it up through the different decades, looking at the history of some of the things that Dick, in this relatively small company, located initially in Buffalo, New York, and then for many years in neighboring Lancaster, New York, of how they set the tone for what a lot of these companies that were larger at the time. Now, again, Max stopped building fire trucks back in 1984 and stopped building, you know, even chassis for the fire industry in 1991. But back in the day, in the 1950s and 60s, when Mack B models and then the cab forward C model was introduced as a takeoff of some things that were done by a bus company, they, with American LaFrance and Ward LaFrance and Maxim, were really the leaders of the fire apparatus industry, and the three or four heavy hitters. There were smaller companies, like out on the West Coast, you had Crown Fire Apparatus that was very popular.
And we had Sanford here in New York.
Right. At one point in the state of New York, and this again goes to show you the impact of what the economy has done over time, but when Mike and I were both youngsters growing up, all right, just in the state of New York, you had American LaFrance located in Elmira, New York, that was probably even in their worst days was turning out several hundred units a year. Very nearby, up the street, literally in Elmira Heights, New York, was Ward LaFrance Fire Apparatus. Located in East Syracuse, New York, was Sanford Fire Apparatus, which had a history as a smaller builder of starting to build commercial trucks, and then that morphed into them building their own fire apparatus. From 1964 up until the early 2000s, you had Salisbury Fire Apparatus, where I worked for a number of years in Tully, New York, and out here in Western New York, you had Dick's Company. So just within the state of New York, there were five very major fire truck builders that if you were a fire department in New York State or in some adjacent state and said, I'm thinking of buying a fire truck, even if you flopped over the state line and went into Pennsylvania, you had Mack Fire Apparatus in Allentown and Hahn Fire Apparatus in Hamburg, Pennsylvania. You had six or seven choices.
And they had Seagraves too.
Right. Literally in your backyard. So for Dick to say, you know, I mean, to say he was up against competition, this is like saying you were playing single A ball and you just got called up to the big leagues and now you're sitting in the dugout with some of the heavy hitters, and Dick's accomplishments certainly speak volumes for what he was able to do. So, in the snorkel device, which your company in particular really pioneered, developed in late 58 and 59, how did you begin an affiliation with them as a small, almost upstart company compared to, you know, some of the people they were dealing with? How did that happen?
Well, I read a newspaper article about this device that was used in Chicago in a fire, where they had strapped a hose to the side of a aircraft. What do you call it when you wash them down so that they don't...
A de-icer.
De-icer. It was de-icer booms, really. And they strapped a hose to the side of that thing and used it in fighting a fire in Chicago. And I saw that and I thought, wow, that's a great idea. So I called the people who built which was the Pittman Company back in those days, and said, I think that's a great idea, and what can we do in the fire service? Well, at that time, they were working on one for Chicago, one that was built with a waterway. So in any event, called them, said we'd like to buy one, and they said, okay, come on out. So my dad and I flew out there, and we got the representation, and then proceeded to design and build one. Then we had to go through the problem. In those days, if you remember, Tom, it was just the NBFU specifications. There were no NFPA specs for trucks in those days. And if you weren't a ladder company, like a snorkel boom didn't fit, you couldn't climb it, let's say. So we had to go through the process of proving to do everything with the snorkel that they could do with the ladder, and as it turned out, we could do more than they could. But it's been an interesting, wonderful challenge. But here again, if we wanted to market, we had to find a market that wasn't totally dominated by the big guys. So we try and design something better.
Yeah, and again, for some of the...
I have a question for Mr. Young. Dick, what kind of competition did your dad face when he first started the company up? And I know this is going back many, many years, but we talk about the Macks and the Hans and
you know, American LaFrance, Ward LaFrance, Sanford, all New York companies in your era of doing business. How about your dad?
Well, I think the thing that is most important to recall is back in those days, and it still is important, but service was a very critical thing. And if you had a truck, how could you get it taken care of? So the fact that we were here in Western New York, and there was a good market from here, let's say, east as far as Syracuse, and maybe down into Pennsylvania, there was a good enough market here to supply or to support a small company and give them good service. And good service was the key. Dad had all of the complications, but as the transportation grew, for example, came back from a show in Maryland, and Maryland Chief Show, and I used to take demonstrator pumpers down there, and it would take really 3 days driving a truck to get down to some of those markets because there were no superhighways. Everything was just a regular road. So today, you know, service is not as nearly as critical as it was back, let's say, in the 40s and early 50s.
You know, if you think about it, if you look at, chronicling a lot of the smaller companies like Dick, it started out building units that go to the principle of easier, more accessible service. They were predominantly all commercial chassis. They were Fords and Chevrolets and Dodges. And again, some names that don't even exist today that don't make products necessarily for the fire service. Young Fire Equipment had, a very unique history of there were several units that they built in the mid-50s where it was actually a Maxim custom cab and chassis, and it had Young body work on it. And that eventually morphed into you then developing your own custom chassis, which kind of then takes us to the Crusader. And again, for our listeners, that was to my way of thinking, the first wide body cab, low profile, just incredible visibility, as Mike mentioned, through the front. And to that point, there were some units that Mike and I sat in during the recent FDIC where we would switch seats, driver, officer, and say, okay, what can you see looking out the front windshield? And with the current design of some of the stuff we put on the dashboard together with all the stuff that we cram inside the cabs, there's a lot of times from the driver's seat you can't even see the edge of the front bumper even if you had some bumper guide-on devices. So, Dick, how did the whole idea of building your own custom cab, and this was built hand-built in your own factory, how did that come about?
Well, here again, it was a matter of if we were going to do something to compete against the trucks that were out there, we had to do things better. We had to have more room, more width in the cab. If you remember, Tom, the custom cab, the engine housings, if you sat on either side, you could get a slow toast on your body. I mean, that was crazy. We had to get rid of that. We had to get rid of some of the noise. We had to improve the vision. We had to get the cabs lower so you didn't have to get on a barrel to get up in it. So it was a matter of design of what would be better for the fire service. And there were a lot of people who, for example, we twisted the gear shift knob so that it wasn't at perfect right angles, which might have looked best in a cab, but it fit your hand. And we had a switch panel that you could feel the different kind of switches, and you knew what switches you were hitting, what you wanted to control. So it was a matter of sitting down with a yellow pad, honestly, you know how fancy that is, but writing down what it is we wanted to accomplish.
This cab you built, I think the prototype was done somewhere around 66, early 67, and you had a very good run of those. There are several of those still running around in service. The very last one, again, and if you happen to be in the Western New York area, believe me, it's worth the trip to go see, but the very last one that was built was a snorkel device that was originally constructed for Tallman, New York, that is now still running today protecting the village of Randolph, New York, down
is
in the
really?
Down in the southern tier of New York. So if you happen to be down in that area going along Interstate 86, even if you have your wife or girlfriend with you, it's worth the sidebar to stop and go take a look at that.
One quick thing, Tom, is that it was very apparent that the visibility in a lot of buses was better than it was in fire trucks. And the front, we found that front section in the Wayne Bus Company down in Pennsylvania, or in Ohio. That's where that, I looked at that front and I said, that's tremendous vision, and it'd be easy to work from. And so that's where we started our design.
Incredible, you know, and to think that was literally done on a sketch pad and then taken all the way through production, where you had engineering drawings and everything. Well, the Crusader 2 morphed into a couple of other custom chassis, and I think one of the ones, again, that you were way ahead of your time when you developed in the early 1980s was coming out with on pumper chassis with mid-engines, and I know you even had done mid-engine chassis for some of the tower devices. Now, where did the concept of the idea come from? At that time, the fire service had pretty much accepted the fact that engine cab forward units, where you had the engine sitting in between the rear-facing jump seats, again, this predates four-door cabs largely, so cabs were considered to be capable of carrying four personnel, or sometimes people would say five, if you were going to ride somebody in between the driver and the officer. But that was pretty common. Conventional custom chassis had just about all but gone away by the late 1960s. So where did you get the idea of coming up with taking the engine completely out of the cab, which, again, that was copied by numerous manufacturers, but in a lot of cases it took them 15 or 20 years after you did it to even get around to recognizing that was a great idea?
Well, Tom, I think you got to put things in that time frame. Number one, it hasn't been all that long that we've had air conditioning in truck cabs, is it?
No, not really.
No,
yep.
So you had all that heat in a cab with no air conditioning in many cases. Then, and here's the biggie, you had so much weight on the front end. Now, if you take a pumper with a 500-gallon tank and an engine over the front axle, you might be able to get some sort of balance, maybe 50-50, but drive home with an empty tank of water, now all your weight's on the front end. So it would be easy to hit the brakes, and now you got a real problem, right? So it was a matter of weight distribution. By taking the engine off the front axle and moving it midships, we wound up with the perfect one-third on the front axle, two-thirds on the rear axle. So it made a lot of sense. Plus, you could open the doors on either side of the engine and walk in and service it. Plus, the fact that there was full power availability that you could come off the front end of the engine. So, you know, why not take advantage of the... Didn't have to invent anything, Tom. Just had to rearrange it a little bit.
Well, when you... Now, you were moving from building your own cab... Inside your manufacturing facility, did you have to go to several different chassis people with this idea to get somebody to buy into the idea? Like, okay, hey, we'll do this for you. I mean, how much faith did they have in what you were trying to propose, since it was so radical?
Well, the Duplex people, it was a great company in its day. They were receptive. It wasn't like a dream, a wild dream. It was like, this is practical. This is stuff that we can do. And it just made a hell of a lot of sense.
So with that then design, Dick, that enabled you to do both. You were doing both pumpers, and you had partnered with LTI in the day, and you were doing rear mount aerial devices with this mid-engine concept as well then.
Yes.
Now, how did you find... After you got the first couple of ones out there, how tough was it of a sell to go into a department? And one I'm thinking in particular was, say, going into a place where I know you had done a lot of business previously in Arlington County, Virginia, in the day, to say, here's what you've been buying, but we've got this whole new concept. How tough was it for you to get the fire service people to accept what you were looking to accomplish?
It really wasn't difficult. It's like, has this been a problem? Like getting at the engine, has it been a problem? Like, if you had to tilt the cab up to get at the engine and you've got an aerial device over the top of the cab, now you've got a problem, right? Well, with ours, you could just open the side doors and get right in at the engine. You didn't have to tilt anything. So that was an easy sell, right? The weight distribution was an easy sell. Getting the heat out of the cab was an easy sell. Getting the noise out of the cab was an easy sell. So really, you know, if we'd have had a bigger marketing group, we could have done a hell of a lot better job, but we just, we're a small company.
Yeah, did this, and we're talking now in the era when you first introduced the mid-engine concept on aerial on tower devices.
Mm-hmm.
You were doing that in 1974, 1975 time frame, and then what you referenced with duplex again, you were doing in the early 1980s, again fully 10 to 12 years before any of the people, the competition, even looked at what you were doing to say maybe this was worthwhile somewhat trying to copy or become a fast follower. So.
I have a question, Tom, for Mr. Young. What company or companies, several companies that your company work with over time, like the LTIs or the Duplex or Simon, what companies did you find easiest to work with in their engineering departments? Because that was quite a feat back in the day to take somebody's chassis and then put somebody's aerial device or something else on it and make it all work.
Well, yes, and that, the fun part about the designing was that, you know, you're responsible for the whole truck from bumper to the tailboard, so you had to be aware of every single detail. But honestly, I found that on pumps, for example, the Hale Pump Company has been a marvelous, very cooperative group. The Pittman Manufacturing that made the snorkel initially, they were fabulously cooperative. LTI, they were all really very, very great. It was a tough market out there, and it was dominated by guys. So if you came along with something new and it made sense, they were all pretty darn happy to oblige.
You know, Mike, that's a great question. It also, again, rolling back in time, the marketplace looked very, very different. When LTI first came into play, while they had a small sub-company that built some bodies for them, LTI sold their aerial devices to a whole number of different manufacturers, including big ones that are around today. That's how Pierce originally got into doing aerials, was partnering with LTI, and companies like Maxim, they sold their aerial devices to other companies as well as the selling them to Mack to make, if somebody had a Mack pumper and they just absolutely had to have a Mack chassis on their aerial for their aerial, Mack didn't build the aerial. They were typically built by Maxim, or in later years some were done by Tebow. So some of the bigger companies, Pierce and Emergency One and even Grumman initially, all started building when they wanted to move like Dick did and expand their product line from pumpers into aerials. Most of the people didn't have the engineering capability nor the manufacturing resources to just wake up some Monday and say, you know what, I sketched some stuff up on Sunday night, I think we're going to start building our first ladder sections, because there was an incredible amount of stuff you had to do behind that. And there were companies, again, like LTI, that's all they did is build aerial devices, and they were selling them to a bunch of people.
And you know, Tim, I think that it would be missing an opportunity if we did not take a minute and talk about the introduction of automatic transmissions. When the automatic transmission came into the fire service, that was probably one of the toughest engineering problems that we had, because you had a torque converter in those days that didn't have proper heat controls, and it didn't hold a speed like we wanted for fire pumping. And it took us probably 4 or 5 years working with Allison to get to the point where we had dependable coordination between the fire pump, the automatic transmission, and the pump operator.
I can remember that. That's a great point there. I can remember very early, while I don't remember specifically who built it, but on some of the very early units that had diesel engines with the first version, the Allison, the HT70, which was a six-speed transmission, that on one manufacturer's unit, this goes back to days when I'm working for ISO, we're going to go do a pump test, and the fellas actually told me, well, you have to throttle up very gradually until the transmission actually shifted up in the sixth gear,
right.
And then you had to keep the engine RPM up that high so the engine wouldn't lose RPM, causing the transmission to downshift. That was one way, and somebody else had worked a method of having an externally controlled, but you had to remember to activate the control. I don't remember whether it was a push knob or a pull knob, yeah. But that was going to hydraulically lock the transmission up in the sixth. And if you neglected to do that, you'd actually hear the transmission and the engine RPM change as you increase the throttle.
And you had to lock up the torque converter so that there was no differential in speed there. Oh, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work.
Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break. This is the Apparatus Architects, Mike Wilver, Tom Shan, and our special guest this month, Mr. Dick Young, formerly of Young Fire Equipment Corporation, and now more recently the immediate past president but founder of Performance Advantage Company. So we'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, welcome back to the Apparatus Architects. This is Mike Wilber along with Tom Shand and our very, very special guest, Mr. Dick Young. And Dick, I'd like to throw another question your way. And never fully understood the demise of Young Fire Apparatus and what actually happened to the company as it disappeared.
Well, Mike, the story is typical of the we used to have, as we talked about before, all of these various manufacturers of fire trucks in New York State, and they're gone. And we had the same problem that they did, which was problems with labor unions. When you're building a fire truck, for example, if you were a pipe fitter where you run manifolds like a rear suction or a front suction, you have to do such as cutting the threads, cutting the pipe, assembling them, welding them, and the people who did that loved to do that. Well, if you belong to a union, you can either be a welder or a pipe cutter, but you can't be both. And, you know, you just can't live with that. Not in a company where you have to do all types of things. So to answer your question, the problem was we had some major problems in the final analysis with the United Auto Workers that we just could not overcome. And they were so severe that the bonding companies who would normally, like we had almost a $5 million order from Dade County, Florida for 14 units, and unfortunately the union came in, established a beachhead, the bonding company then refused to bond us. And when we couldn't come to terms with the union on some of these crazy things that they demanded, which were work rules, it wasn't the money, it was the work rules. And so when we couldn't come to terms with them, the bank called a $500,000 loan, and the next thing you know, we were in an avalanche that we couldn't stop. So the bottom line is that we had serious labor complications that we couldn't overcome.
As we had discussed before, it wasn't just your company that was taken out of the mix in New York either, correct?
That's true. Would you believe it or not, when American LaFrance closed, the president there told me that they still had a union of buggy whip installers. Can you imagine? That's how old the company was. But the union was buggy whip installers. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
Well,
moving on, another question. Composites have become quite popular now, composite bodies. But and it's like everything else in the fire service. I find interesting that Somebody comes up with an idea 20 years after somebody else, and it's all bright and new. A good example of that would be like rear steer. The first rear steer units, and Tom, you can correct me if I'm wrong, were actually built by Seagrave called Rear Admirals back in the early 70s. In fact, I think the city of Chicago got a couple, and yet that was reintroduced in the 90s by a couple of different manufacturers as being something bright, shiny, and new that had never been done before. And the same way now, I think, with composites. Dick, you had worked on composites back in the 80s, correct?
Yes, Mike. Here in Western New York, and I'm sure it's true of most of the Northeast, it seems we plow our streets with salt. And no matter what you do with metals, if you have a dissimilar metal, like you put a stainless steel bolt through an piece of aluminum or steel, you're going to get corrosion around that fitting. And so corrosion was causing us to lose tremendous good bodies that were just subjected to being bathed in salt all the time. So it was very obvious that boats, which, again, we didn't have to invent a technology. We just used that technology to design a body that was made of fiberglass, and it was bolt together sections, so if one got damaged, it was easy to take it apart, take another molded part, and bolt it right in.
So these composite bodies that you developed, Dick, was the body structure, you were still using a steel substructure of sorts?
Yes, we were using a galvanized, once we had made that substructure, we hot-tip galvanized it and bolted it to the truck frame, and it could flex with the truck, and then the body modules were mounted on top of that.
So take on a pumper body where you had three compartments on each side and a rear compartment, you had a total of seven different bolt-together modules?
Yes.
And the doors as well, this is, again, we're predating back prior to roll-up doors really taking off, but these were hinge doors, and the doors were composite as well?
Yes.
Why do you suppose, Dick, that idea really never took off, but yet moved the clock ahead here, moved the calendar ahead 20 years, and all of a sudden it's back on the landscape again?
Well, I think it's easy to see, Mike, that the big companies, again, their tooling investment was for steel or aluminum or stainless steel. They had to fight for their market share, and the only way they could do it was to find a way to try to squash what we did. So that's, understandable marketing. It's just getting out there. But we had tremendous success. We never had any one of our molded bodies that failed anybody. And after all these years, and if I was still in the business, I would still be building them that way.
Mike, just about 2 weeks ago, I happened to be at a local fire company doing, not surprisingly, some apparatus photography for an upcoming article. And these people had, it was a reserve unit, but a 1986 pumper built by Dick on a C model Ford that had this composite body. And I swear to you, I opened all six compartments on that vehicle, three on the left, two on the right, and a rear. And there was not a hint of rust or damage or body deformation on that unit anywhere on a 24-year-old pumper. And I can assure you, having lived in upstate New York between Syracuse and Buffalo here for the better part of the last 25 years, you can't find too many 24-year-old fire trucks that even exist, period, right? No matter whose nameplate was on them. And, this body was good enough. If you wanted to take that thing off and re-chassis it, you'd be good to go. And I think Dick's point was really well taken. If you think about whoever our listeners in your own mind, based on where you are geographically in the country, whoever the top two or three producers or sellers of apparatus are in your area, there are some builders that only build in one body material. They may only build, for example, in aluminum. There are several manufacturers that only build in stainless steel. There's a couple that it's kind of like going into the ice cream shop. There's two or three different flavors you can have. And that really is what they're selling is their design. Probably, I think because of Dick's background with Young Fire Equipment, that after their restart up after one of the union strikes they had, they came back for several years in just rebuilding rigs. So, Dick, you learned a lot by taking apart everybody's fire trucks to see what wasn't holding up.
Yep. It was amazing how pumpers that, let's say you call it custom. Wow, that's great. It's a custom. Well, I hate to tell you that some of the customs were just junk. They might have had a custom-built chassis, but they weren't well-built.
Yeah, and there were units I can recollect that Dick rebuilt. We won't mention the brand, but these units were less than 10 years old. They were between 5 to 10 years old, and the bodies were completely shot to the point where if you looked at it, the body was sitting cockeyed on the frame, and it was because it was already rotted, and what was holding it up had already, you know, had given way. So it's, again, for our listeners, history repeats itself. If you've been in the fire service for 5 or 10 years, I would highly recommend that if you're going to make your career in this, whatever your vocation is, engine work, ladder work, technical rescue, you're going to be involved with apparatus specification development and writing point, pick up a few of these books and look at what happened in the past to help you learn to not repeat the mistakes of the past, but look at, again, some of the true innovators like Dick, that they were coming up with ideas 10, 15, 20 years ahead of what some of the big players were doing. And once again, it goes to all of Dick's credit. So
can I throw a word in here? I haven't said this before, but Mike and Tom, I love what you do. I think the apparatus architects is such an important operation. So many people who buy apparatus have no idea what they're buying, have no idea what to look for. You can give them the experience that you have to help them come up with an apparatus that will be their best buy in the long run. And I applaud you for doing all you do for the fire service. You're unique, I guess. I don't know there's anybody else that does what you do. Is that right?
Well, I think there's probably some other people in different parts of the country, but I'd say that maybe individually we're not too unique, but if you put Shan and Wilbur together on the front bumper of a fire truck, you've got a unique pair.
I think so, yeah. Good job.
But thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us up to your current endeavors. So take us, you've gone from the fire truck world and you're now working with, you know, and had developed and the founder of Performance Advantage Company. What was your premise for deciding that I'm going to go from building a whole fire truck and now I'm going to be building very unique and brackets to hold what you firefighters use?
Well, thank you. That's a good question. First of all, one of the things that was apparent in building fire trucks was that there were no good mounting brackets for tools and equipment that were not, for example, made of dissimilar metals. You can't take a bronze axe sheath, for example, and bolt it to aluminum with a stainless steel bolt and not expect to have trouble. So it was very clear that there was a need for good mounting brackets for tools and equipment. A, B, there was a good need to use materials that would not corrode. High strength, flexible, unable, that would not give your body any problems. And the technology to do that was right here in Western New York. We had two major manufacturers who had the tooling and the equipment. And it was here again, it was a matter of working with people. I come up with the brackets, come up with the prototypes and the designs, and if it looks good, then we go to the local people here, and it's wonderful because it's just their experience of many, many years in fabricating things out of high strength nylon, for example, is fantastic. So again, it was apparent there was a need for good mounting brackets for tools and equipment. Every year, there's some new tools that are invented that are, everybody's got to have them on their fire truck. How do you mount them? Where do you mount them?
What kind of curve did this throw to you, or tell our listeners through the process when the NFPA and the 1901 committee, because of accidents and people just in the past taking their favorite Hydra Ram and pair of irons and just putting them on the floor inside the cab because it was convenient, when the NFPA developed the standard that everything had to be in, again, we'll put in parentheses, this 9G bracket, what did you have to do as a producer of these, Dick, to say, to actually test and certify that you know your brackets, worst case scenario, will meet the needs and meet the requirements of that particular standard?
Well, it was necessary to build some prototypes and take the prototypes to the Akron Rubber Development Lab in Akron, Ohio, where they did the actual testing of our units to see that they did meet the NFPA requirements. And then beyond that, we started to make a lot of the brackets for the military. We're standard equipment now in the Navy on all new ships, all new builds, to hold the tools and equipment that they have for firefighting, damage control, also for the storage of their special suits and gas masks and things like that. But there we had to go through Navy testing too. So it's been a long, long process of testing to make sure we meet their specifications.
So it was a Navy testing, Dick, more rigorous or a more rigid standard than what we have here in the fire service through the NFPA?
The fire service requires the ability to withstand a 9G. That's the max that you're going to put on the bracket. In the Navy, it's 150 Gs.
That sounds like a 9.0 magnitude earthquake, Dick.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing of it is about G-forces is it's like in the Navy, for example, it's an instantaneous. It's a fraction of a second that this force is put on it. So because we have elasticity in the materials of the bracket, the elasticity will allow it to absorb some of that time before we come to the absolute load.
So were you able to use the same testing organization to test?
No. We had to use Navy certified testing organizations.
Okay. So they had a listing of testing labs that were acceptable to them to do your...
Yes, one was in Virginia and one was in New Jersey. Yeah.
So you have obviously high confidence in your bracket. If you say that this bracket to hold your irons inside the cab of your fire and G, as my dad used to say, you can go to bed, you can sleep at night. You know that 9G, it's not like 8 or 7.5. It's going to more than pass muster.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, we just said, how high can we go? And the highest we could go on that machine was 18 Gs. But we did. You know, and I was kind of, oh my God, will it do it? But it did.
So, how, again, if we take a look at some of your initial offerings where you had the handle lock and some of the other mechanisms to hold tools, these were things you just looked at the kind of tools people were carrying on apparatus and say, how can I improve on what, you know, how can I improve on an axe scabbard and a tulip clip, which was...
Yeah, right. Well, the first thing... Tom, did you ever see anybody put away a clean axe?
Not generally. Not taken up from the
run.
I mean,
it's always got goop from the ceiling or from the roof or whatever. You're going to put dirty crap in, so why put it in a chrome scabbard? You know, first place, it's not going to fit very well. It needs something that it can bounce around in, easy in, easy out, simple. If you kick it, bump it, doesn't break. That's what we need. So that's what we did.
Yeah. If you look at, again, we go back and just and can recollect in my fire service career, growing up as a little kid, remembering seeing fire trucks go by in a parade, the era of cab forward apparatus, axes were always carried on the side of the cab in the area of the jump seat. There'd be a flathead axe on one side and a pickhead axe on the other side, and the idea would be the fireman would come out in later years when we put SCBA brackets in the seats, he could come out and grab an axe. Later on, then, we get into canopy cab rigs or four-door cab rigs, and people then typically took that axe and mounted it alongside the engine box or on top of the engine box. So now it's in the enclosed environment where we are. So we've, kind of going full circle. If people took it out of the cab, and now largely because of the NFPA standard and what people perceive they need to put in the cab, we find people using your brackets to hold all kinds of stuff, in there. How did, one of your other more, to me, your excellent products that has just a multitude of applications is the pack track material that your bracketry kind of mates up with. How did that come about? And please don't tell me again that was started out with a yellow pad sketch. But maybe it did.
Tom, I'm going to tell you something. That you're a volunteer in fire department?
Yeah, down in Hamburg. Yep.
Down in Hamburg. Sold some brackets to Hamburg. I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to anyhow. Sold brackets in the early days, and they mounted them on the back wall of a compartment over the wheel housing, and I couldn't wait to get there to see it, because they said, come take pictures. So I came over there with my camera to take pictures of the brackets holding whatever they were holding. And I said, oh, isn't that is so pretty. It's made a beautiful picture. And I reached up and grabbed a hold of one of the brackets and pulled it, and it came right off in my hand. They had put it on, drilled through steel, and put it on with wood screws. Now, you know that's not going to work. So I said right then and there, two things. First of all, we're going to sell our brackets. They're going to be complete with the mounting, the bolts and nuts that you have to have, A. And B, we need to come up with a surface where you can put the brackets wherever you want to. So design of Pack Track was to do the ability so that anybody could mount a bracket anywhere at any time. And then the father of it, Tom, was your fire company.
Whoever coined the expression, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So you develop one part of the component thinking that this is going to solve some of the attendant issues, and then in the first couple of installations you see it's like, okay, we need an A plus B to equal C to get this to work.
Yeah, we call it now tool mounting systems because it's a system rather than just brackets.
And you have resources here within Performance Advantage that if I'm an assistant chief or a captain in charge of an engine company and we're getting a new rig and I've got a whole bunch of tools but I'm not sure how they want to outfit them, you've got people here that people can call or email or talk to and get some advice over the best methods to utilize to be able to utilize your equipment or other ideas to make it safe for the people to operate around the rigs.
Yes, and we can send you engineering drawings on all of the products, whatever you need. Or even send you some to try.
There you go, our listeners. One of the things that Mike and Tom, no matter what topic we're talking about, and it can even be some pretty sensitive stuff when we start getting in the engine versus the truck stuff, is it's all about safety. And no matter what brand of fire truck you're operating, no matter what your budget is, no matter where you're located in this country, or as Dick's products are obviously out on the high seas, you know, protecting our sailors who are ultimately protecting us and our freedoms. It's all about doing things safe. So if you can't do things safely and then train safely to operate safely, it's about time to blow the whistle and call a timeout and make sure that stays in the forefront of everything we do. And that particularly poignant being that we're coming up, next week is going to be the annual safety week for the fire service here in the United States to look at operating and doing things that we do in a safe and sane manner to reduce the line of duty injuries and ultimately to have an impact on reducing the line of duty deaths. So just wrapping up, Dick, where do you see from your perspective with all the years that you've been working with the fire service, where do you see us in the next 5 to 10 years going, or you know, where would you like it? If you had the ability to direct us and move us on a Ouija board, you know, where do you think we're missing a boat for something that we need to be doing to provide better services?
Now I think trucks are getting too big. Fire trucks are getting too big. Their height is ridiculous. You need a ladder to get up to the hose. It doesn't make any sense to me. We're trying to do too much on one package, which more horsepower. They're loading these trucks with humongous engines and humongous pumps, and you're never able to use the pumping capacity. I think, for the most part, if I were in the business, I would be in a smaller, more maneuverable, more fireman-friendly pumper, and I would put all of the gear, not all of the gear, but put all of the rescue stuff on a different rig. I mean, our demo, for example, it goes to shows, and it covers thousands of miles with no sweat, and it's got tons of stuff in it, and you're not... You need a separate truck for all of the equipment you're carrying, I guess is what I'm saying.
Very interesting. Michael, any parting thoughts or comments or questions you'd like to throw at Dick before we wrap up here?
Well, I would just like to personally thank Dick Young for joining us today. It was a real treat for me, and I hope our listeners feel the same way. We really have what I would consider an icon in the fire apparatus business that we were able to sit down and chat with and get some insight from. And I would just like to personally thank Dick for taking the time out of his busy day and continued success with PAC. It's an awesome product. You are just have worked tirelessly on behalf of firefighters and firefighter safety and the military as well. And to you, sir, you should be commended.
Well, thank you, Mike. You know, the beautiful part is if you can ever get a job where you love what you do and you wake up every morning and you can't wait to get to work, that's my job. I love it. So, and I love the guy. I love the guys like Tommy, whom I've known for many, many years. I knew him when his hair was red.
Mike, it's like working up each day and knowing you're going to work in the engine. You're just going to have a great day no matter what the Lord throws at you there,
yes,
brother.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my worst nightmare come true.
Anyhow, it's a wonderful business, wonderful people, and I thank you for this opportunity to chat with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we're wrapping up here. This is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, wrapped up this month's session with Mr. Dick Young. Mike and Tom will be down at the upcoming Firehouse Expo in Baltimore the third week of July, putting on a couple of different programs. And if there's anything we can do for you in the interim, you can reach us at podcast@firehouse.com or our website, emergencyvehiclerespondse.com. So for Mike Wilbur, for Mr. Dick Young, Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, stay well and be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.